Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to Lore Watch, a roundtable freeform discussion about lore in the games of Blizzard Entertainment. I'm Anne Stickney, one of two lore-focused writers on Blizzard Watch, and I've got both of my wonderful co-hosts with me today. First up, he's the other lore-focused writer over on Blizzard Watch. That would be Matt Rossi. Hey, Rossi, how's it going?
let's just talk about games for a while. That is what we should do.
Okay, that's fine. We've also got our other co-host with us today. He's another lore aficionado and a shaman columnist as well. That would be Joe Perez. Hey, Joe.
Well, hello.
Hi. How are you doing?
I've actually been in a good mood because I've had a tiny human to play with.
A tiny human? Oh, the new tiny human?
The new tiny human. So aww. I've been spending a lot of time with my niece, which is absolutely fantastic. And I've already deposited a whole bunch of nerdy clothing for her, which my sister... kind
as
of,
you should.
She looked at very funnily, and my brother-in-law was just like, yes, she'll be wearing these. Thank you.
Good. I hope you got her some good stuff. Anyway.
Of course I did.
All right. Well, today we've actually got... I decided to go ahead... Okay. So, Chronicle Volume 3, we talked about that on the last episode. It actually comes out this week, but we don't actually have it in our hands as of yet, so we can't really discuss it in detail. That will be the next episode, I'm pretty sure. So if you have any questions for Chronicle Volume 3 material specifically, go ahead and email those to us at podcast@blizzardwatch.com. Put Lore Watch in the subject line so that we know that it's intended for this show, because we will be going over all of that in 2 weeks' time. Today, however... guess what? We had a whole mess of other email sitting in the inbox. So I figured, you know what? We should probably dig through some of that. And our first email actually isn't World of Warcraft related, which is why I included it, because I was like, yay, we're going to talk about other games just for a little bit. It's an Overwatch question, and this is from Godzilla, who's a loyal patron. Thank you, Godzilla. God. G-A-W-D. Gawd. I don't even know what I'm saying. Right, regardless, question says, hello, Lorewatch, not to be confused with Overwatch or Blackwatch. I have some questions, pick your brain thoughts, regarding the lore of Overwatch. We've gotten a lot of Talon lore recently, between the additions of Sombra, Doomfist, and Moira to the games roster, and it's got me taking a step back and re-examining Talon. Before the revelation that Talon was... a council or had a high table, I always kind of assumed that Talon had a singular leader in the form of Blofeld, Claw, or Cobra Commander-like character. So my first question is this. Would you prefer that Talon had a singular leader, or do you prefer the idea of the different factions, like Reapers, X-Black, Watch, all of that? Now, I don't know how much you two are into Overwatch lore, but I'm just going to let you go. What do you guys think? Would you rather Talon had, like, one big bad, or do you like the idea of having, like, a roundtable group?
See, even if they had one big bad, it would end up with a bunch of factions anyway. So I kind of like the idea that they're somewhat egalitarian, especially since we have Sombra involved. And we know Sombra's only there because she's trying to unravel a greater mystery.
She's like, not really in she's in Talon, but she's not really in Talon.
She's
there because it serves her needs.
Yeah, she does contracting, basically. And they all know she's not loyal to them, but that's, you know, all part of the game. She's with her there, and you know she's only involved because she's trying to unravel a deeper mystery. It's possible there is a big bad out there who's ultimately in charge, who's, you know, responsible for Talon and other stuff. There certainly is possibly a linkage to the Omnic Crisis because of that whole map she had going on, the symbols map she had.
The global conspiracy. Yeah.
So right now I like Talon as it is because it allows Talon to be its own discrete entity and not... It takes a little bit of a step away from being actually a G.I. Joe villain. I mean, that's... You don't want them to actually be Cobra. That's not... You know, it's fine that they feel a little like Cobra. They have, you know, sort of that global terrorist inspiration. But you don't want them to literally be lifted from the comic book. You want
Plus
them to have
their
own
feel.
Plus,
you got all the ninja dudes that infiltrated during the whole recall cinematic thing. Mm-hmm. They felt very G.I. Joe. Ninja Squad, yeah. Whatever.
So you want to give them their own identity. Plus, I mean, I'm trying to remember the comic that I read it in. I don't remember if it's the one where I think it's the one where Doomfist goes to the casino.
Masquerade.
Yeah, that one definitely gives you the feel. There's even more factions than these guys. There's that weird Omnic dude.
Yeah, there were some pretty interesting characters that we didn't even get a look at. I mean, we got like a panel, but we don't know who they are even really.
So yeah, I my statement is that I am okay with it as a kind of round table of evil, for lack of a better word.
And I'm more than okay with it. I actually prefer this. And I kind of get tired of the whole big bad thing, because a big bad gives you the impression that it's just one misguided person or one person, you know, going against the system. But when you have like a council like this, when you have a group that is organizing much in the same way that leaders from the, you know, the normal societal factions meet and sort of have like, you know, discussions about what they're going to do next and pick a direction, despite what their individual motivations might be, it gives it more weight almost, because there's not just, oh, I just go and lop the head off the vampire and then all the thralls are free and they can come back to normal society. No, not here. And it gives it this depth that, as an organization, I feel a lot of villainous groups in literature and comics and movies lack, because you either have one genius person who has nothing but lackeys, or you have a group of people or a group of individuals that they're working together because what they want at this moment temporarily aligns in such a way that they become a force to be reckoned with. And that's what it feels like here. Like there's more individual sort of motivations for each of them. There are different factions, like everybody's been saying, and that's cool, because what happens when, you know, their goal is accomplished, or if it gets accomplished, what happens then? Do they just split up and go their different ways? Does somebody else say, well, okay, now it's time for this. And then they do all, you know, does it open up a whole new avenue of battery to happen? And I like that. I like that depth. I like that feeling of it being bigger than one person. And I also like the idea of maybe these groups of people that, you know, they don't generally like each other, maybe come together to pool their resources to make an impact towards that one goal, versus, you know, the stereotypical rich arch villain, like, you know, your Blofelds, your Claws, your Cobra Commanders. Like they're cool in their own right. They have their place, but this is so much better for me in this particular setting. It makes more sense.
See, and I feel like we've gotten an illustration of both of those scenarios, and as a whole, we've gotten a better look at Talon out of it, because Doomfist was that leader at one point in time. Like he was leading Talon and calling the shots until he got taken down. And you would expect that with a leader taken down like that, okay, cool, everybody scatters to the winds or whatever. That's not what happened. So if anything, Doomfist's capture and his subsequent jail time that he, you know, all that time that he spent in prison, Talon went right along on without him, without any Like, it was barely a blip in the radar, and maybe all of those disparate little branches of Talon weren't necessarily working together, but they were still working. It was sort of like Talon, yes, but Talon's also kind of like a Hydra, haha, let's G.I. Joe reference this, why not? Where you cut one head off, and it doesn't matter, because all of the other heads are still there, and possibly more spring up in that leader's absence. So when we saw Doomfist come back in that Masquerade comic, what it felt like to me was he was coming back not to sit at the table or whatever, but he was coming back to try and reestablish that dominance that he had. And I don't think that he's going to be able to manage it. So I think that there's, I think Doomfist's story in particular is going to be really interesting going forward from here, because he's this guy who was in that leadership role, and then he had that taken away from him. And when he comes back, that organization that he comes back to is not the same one that he left behind. Like, not even a little. And I don't think that he's quite absorbed all of that as of yet. I don't think he's had time to absorb all of that as of yet.
See, and I think it goes deeper than that, too, because if you look at anything that we've seen produced or written or put out there for, you know, Doomfist before he sat at the head of that table, so to speak, he climbed up the ranks through Talon. He wasn't just the de facto leader. It wasn't created under him. Like,
he took out the previous leader.
Well, he took out his teacher. He took out his teacher and like then started becoming this driving force within Talon, right? Like, so I think that's kind of important, is like he sort of wrestled that and gave it a direction. He took that weapon and gave it a direction to fire at.
What I find interesting though is Doomfist has this particular ideology of what the world needs to be, and not everybody in Talon necessarily agrees with or wants that same thing that he's looking for. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that he was as cognizant of that when he got captured initially as he is right now.
The impression I get is that he didn't care, more or less. Like, yeah. he was the biggest bad in the room, so to speak, at the time, so he could make them do what he wanted. Everything else be darned. And I think that's also kind of why when he was captured, Talon kept going, because it wasn't just his, right?
It wasn't about him.
Exactly. It never was.
It had maybe grown beyond him before he even got arrested in the first place.
I think the impression that I get from all the stuff that I've read is that it was bigger than him before he sort of sat in that position of power. Like, it was already there and established, and he just sort of refocused everybody's efforts under the threat of being punched. So,
and I mean, if we want to go back to Sombra's global conspiracy chart, it's obvious there's more at play here than just Talon. Talon is not the singular big bad in the Overwatch universe. There's all kinds of things out there that aren't necessarily under the Talon umbrella, as it were. Hey, umbrella, there's another bad group. Anyway, they just keep popping up. I don't know what to say. Anyway, it's kind of obvious that Talon isn't working. Talon may be working alone and doing its own thing, but simultaneously there are other groups around the world that are doing exactly the same thing, just through different means. They don't necessarily report to Talon or even acknowledge that Talon exists. They're just doing their own thing. So, I don't know.
Well,
I don't know if there's a singular big bad at the top of this big pyramid of global conspiracy or whatever. Or maybe the global conspiracy is just like these groups are actually working together, we don't know about it, or something else. I don't know.
Yeah, for me, at least, the point is that the possibility exists either way. Mm-hmm. And it's almost better not to know. But if you wanted to have a singular Dr. Doom at the top of the temple, you totally could. Or you could have, that's a useful myth that each group could exploit for their own benefit. Or, you know, there's plenty of options. We don't know enough yet to make a decision one way or the
other. Wouldn't you hate to be that guy? The guy that everybody points at and says, oh yeah, it was all his planning.
Well, and that makes me wonder, right? Like, that makes me wonder if that was sort of the whole reason that Doomfist got hung out to dry in the first place, was because let's just pin this on him and then we can go back doing to what we were wanted to be doing because he's a problem. We need to get rid of him. Like, I'm wondering how much of that is in there too.
Well, it seems pretty obvious from the Masquerade comic that the I keep forgetting the name of the Omnic that he talks to, but that Omnic very, very clearly did not was not necessarily happy Doomfist was back.
No, and I can't remember the guy's name either. But yeah, there was an Omnic there, and the implication was that he was not alone in not necessarily being super gung-ho about the fact that Doomfist was back. Like, a lot of people had moved on and actually done better without Doomfist around. So his reappearance was kind of like a, oh, he's back.
And there's whoever this Viali guy is.
Yeah.
He's like, you know, the one that when he ordered the assassination of Volskaya and so forth. And Doomfist is like, you know, but he also ordered a hit on Doomfist and Widowmaker. I mean, he was trying to have them killed. So.
Oh, and the Omnic's name is Maximilian.
Is it just Maximilian?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, speaking of Widowmaker, the second part of this email has a question about her. Second question has to do with Widowmaker. I'm starting to wonder just how much did Talon actually brainwash her? If we go by the Alive cinematic, the Reflections and Masquerade comics, and the Chateau Gilliard map, I probably just mangled the pronunciation of that. I apologize to French speakers everywhere. It seems there might not be much of a divide between who she was before and who she is now, the Widowmaker personality. We saw her visit Gerard's grave. We see Reaper and Doomfist actually addressing her as LaCroix, not Widowmaker. I can't help but feel there's more to Widowmaker's story than a simple case of Winter Soldier-itis. But I'm wondering what you guys think about that. What do you guys say? Do you think Widowmaker is, like, completely brainwashed, or do you think that those instances, like the instances where she goes back and she visits Gerard's grave and all of this other stuff, these are just like cracks?
Doesn't she get really mad if, I think Mercy says that you didn't deserve to be with him, and she goes, you knew nothing about him or something?
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to remember the exact exchange.
I think so. It was something like that, yeah.
It's possible we haven't heard enough about Gerard that we don't actually know what the relationship was, that we've gotten an idealized view of it, and it wasn't so much a brainwashing as it was a giving someone the opportunity to do something. We don't know. I mean, that's the thing. We know very little. We've never seen them actually interact. We've only read, like, secondhand or thirdhand reports about it afterwards.
Well, there's an interesting thing about that too, though, right? And we've talked about this before in the past when we've pointed out, like, some of the other shorts that we've seen in videos and established things. We've never actually seen, like, Reaper or, you know, Widowmaker actually, like, aside from the one target, right? Who else have they killed? Like, we've seen, like, in the short where Reaper's fighting Winston, he very easily could have killed Winston. And he didn't. He shot him in the armor. He knew the armor was going to protect him. He could have shot him in the face. He didn't. Like, I don't know if there was more going on there with Talon and Black Watch than we think. And this is something that I've been floating around for a while. I can't help but think that maybe Gerard's death wasn't necessarily Talon planned. Like, I'm not entirely convinced that he decided, because he was supposed to be spearheaded against the Talon organization. But if you need to motivate somebody to go after a group with more fire in their belly than they necessarily would have, a death is a great way to do that. Sacrificing, becoming a martyr might be the motivation that they needed.
They tried to assassinate him several times over, and Gerard kept avoiding it. So that's why they turned to his wife.
Right, but I want to know more about him specifically, because to see if that would be something in his mindset where it's like, they keep trying this, you know, maybe a successful one needs to happen. Like, I don't know. I'm curious about that.
It's kind of an interesting thought.
I'm going to call it here now. He faked his death.
He faked his death. Hero number 28, Gerard. That would be really weird, but also kind of cool, and would be really interesting for the whole Widowmaker dynamic thing.
He's secretly that Italian, you know.
He's the guy at the top of the pyramid. It was Gerard all along. One final thought here from Godzilla, who says, and we can all agree that Sombra by far is the most nefarious of the Talon quintet. Thanks again, Godzilla.
Moira experiments on
yeah.
people. I mean, no.
Yeah.
Well, I think
I'm going to go with Moira on this one too. I think I'm with Rossi.
Well, the thing is like, okay, there's a difference here though. 'Cause Moira isn't performing her experiments or anything out of a willingness to do evil or any particular kind of malevolence or anything. She just wants to do her experiments. And maybe those experiments aren't the most ethical things in the world, so the rest of the world is kind of, the scientific community is kind of like, no, how about we not do that? The reason Moira is okay with Talon is because Talon's like, yeah, sure, we'll go ahead and fund you. We'll let you research whatever the heck you want as long as we get the results. And she's okay with that. She hasn't really got, I don't think that she's really nefarious and or a malevolent entity per se. I think that she's very focused on her science more so than ethics or, you know, whether or not being concerned with the moral implications of what she's doing. So I don't think that Moira really fits the nefarious label. And I don't know if Sombra fits it either, honestly.
Sombra's only there because she's trying to determine the truth about the organizations that may have destroyed everything she ever cared about.
I think out of everyone, maybe Reaper. Because Reaper was playing for the good guys, and he deliberately flipped.
No, it's Doomfist, if we're going to do that.
I was going to say Doomfist is probably the most nefarious, because he actually actively wants to murder people and incite a war.
Yeah, true. True.
But I mean, I'm not backing down on Moira, because Moira, everything you just said about her doesn't make her less nefarious. It makes her more nefarious, because it makes her more selfish and more willing to hurt people without even caring. She doesn't hurt people because she's evil. She doesn't hurt people because she enjoys their suffering. She hurts people because it doesn't matter to her at all.
Yeah,
and like, she'd step on you.
It's not a person to her. It's a test subject.
Yeah, so that's not better.
It's not better, but what I'm arguing here is that she doesn't really come from a place of outward malevolence. We do have people in Talon who are very blatantly doing so.
Yeah, but I mean, like, by the definition of the word nefarious, I mean wicked, abominable, impious. Like, that hits Moira and her experimentation, as far as I'm concerned.
I will say this. None of the people in Talon, none of them, are just, yes, it's evil time. I mean,
I don't think so.
Doomfist wants to make a world. He thinks people will get better if he makes the world a place of conflict. He thinks personal strength comes from overcoming conflict. Reaper wants revenge for what has happened to his life, as far as we know, anyway. Widowmaker, she's kind of emotionless, and Talon operations are the closest she can get to feeling alive. At least that's what we've been told. Sombra has very definite reasons for why she's there. And Moira, as you laid out Moira's reasonings, no one here is like evil. You know what I mean? There's no supervillains. There's nobody who just sits in their black cloak cackling. I mean, one of them has a castle. We do have one of them that has her own castle, but she doesn't spend time in the castle stroking her pet cat and, you know, plotting evil deeds.
I think that's kind of what I appreciate actually about Talon and Overwatch in general, is that none of the villains are quite as black and white as you would get in other video game titles. You know what I mean? Like, everybody's got a motivation to do what they're doing, and maybe that motivation isn't the correct motivation, but it's there.
Well, we mentioned before Blofeld, Claw, or Cobra Commander as the leaders of Talon, like the models for it. Another reason why I think it's good they don't have one is because then it would be easier for them to have that kind of thing. To have the evil villain masterminding everything for his evil plan. If you've got people with goals that are like in opposition, working together on a high council type thing, then you have tension and conflict without everything being about someone's evil plan. Like, if you've got guys,
I just kind of appreciate, and I mean, maybe it's like throwback to Warcraft here or whatever. I kind of appreciate that we don't have a Gul'dan type character here, where it's just evil for the sake of being evil.
Even Gul'dan, the modern Gul'dan, the one we have right now,
They tried. They were like, he was like kicked around and treated really badly and everything.
That's not what I mean, though. I'm not saying that. I'm saying he's not evil for the sake of evil. He's evil for the sake of power.
Yeah, but it's just that one selfish reason, and that's it. It's all about him.
Gul'dan is still the guy that destroyed his own race and then made Death Knights just because.
I mean, if murdering a puppy would give him more power, he would absolutely murder that puppy, no questions asked.
But I mean, you could use the Talon litmus test. I mean, Moira would kill that puppy in a heartbeat if she'd learned something from it.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas Sombra wouldn't kill the puppy because there's no way that's going to help her, you know, undo the global conspiracy. Reaper's like, why am I killing a puppy? What the heck's the puppy going to... The puppy didn't get me here. Widowmaker's like, that's not hard, so I don't want to do it. And
Widowmaker like, would kill the puppy if somebody ordered her to kill the puppy.
Yeah, but that's all part of a mission. She's not going to go out and do it.
She's not going to go out and just do it herself.
Yeah, and Doomfist would crush the puppy if somehow that was going to cause a global conflict. Otherwise, I don't see
if it incited war, he would probably crush the puppy.
Wow.
And now I'm thinking of that comic where the Infinity War starts and, you know, Doctor Strange tells Thanos that the last Infinity Stone is inside of a puppy, and then John Wick comes onto this, you know, the page.
Oh, jeez.
Beautiful. Two of the people on this chat have puppies, so now at least two of us are probably a little sad.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. We brought the puppy analogy in for a reason. Anyway, moving on. We do have more emails. These ones are more Warcraft related, so let's jump in on those. First one is from Vestarin, a balanced druid, who says, "Hello, lore watchers. I'm working on Lore Master in Silverpine, and I recently listened to the Chronicle 3 preview episode." That's the last episode we did. "It really brought to mind the similarity between Sylvanas and even some of the NPC quest givers to Arthas and presumably Bolvar and Legion. All of them seem to come to the same solution. Make everyone undead. Is it just a case of it's tempting if the only tool you have is a hammer to treat everything as if it were a nail? Or is there something in the nature of being undead that shapes your thinking in this manner? If not a Shadowlands entity, some fundamental force at work in the undead. Do the Forsaken and Sylvanas have as much free will as they think they do? Or are they only free to exercise their free will if it tends towards the goals of some greater force? Love the show. Keep up the good work, Vestarin." That's actually a really good point, because Sylvanas, it's like her goals kind of align with the same sort of thing that Arthas was doing. And you know, that was one of those questions that I had in Cataclysm in particular. Not so much in Mist, because she kind of fell by the wayside. Same thing in Warlords of Draenor, kind of fell by the wayside. But in Cataclysm, there was that kind of the whole issue with the Valkyr and propagating the undead species and making sure they don't die out and all of that other stuff. And it made me wonder, how close of a line is she towing to the same ideals that Arthas had? And given what we learned with that Chronicle 3 preview, as far as Arthas and how he viewed the rest of the world, and how he thought, or the Lich King thought anyway, that the Scourge would succeed where mortals or, you know, living creatures would not, it almost blurs that line even further. What do you guys think?
I've always felt like it's not just Sylvanas. It's basically a lot of the undead seem to feel this way, like that. And a lot of, I've had arguments with people who play undead who make this argument that, you know, well, once you're undead, you're basically unstoppable. You don't have to worry about aging anymore. You're not going to die because you're already dead. And I think it is to a certain degree. I don't want it to be there's a greater force making it happen, because if there's a greater force making it happen, that's less interesting to me. Because then we just have the greater force to deal with. And you can argue, well, you can't deal with the greater force, but we just put Sargeras in a bottle. I think we can deal with any greater force. So that's not as interesting to me as it just being Sylvanas's mindset. Like, being dead means that you look at the world differently. How many times has she said that? Like, she can't feel the same way anymore. And if you look at War Crimes, it's even her solution to personal problems.
Oh, yeah.
My sister is here, and I want to have my sister with me, and I miss my sister, and therefore I'll kill her and raise her as undead. And then she, you know, everything will be fine. Like, that's Sylvanas really does kind of approach the world as a how will a bunch of undead make this better? Or how will undeath solve this problem? And I do think to a certain degree it's rooted in, when she started off, it was always, what are we if not slaves to this torment? She doesn't say that much anymore. You know, she's not the Sylvanas who viewed undeath as a curse and hated it. That's not who she is anymore. I don't know if it's just being undead that makes that happen, or if it's, since you're undead, you tend to look at the world that way. That I can't answer.
Well, I think part of it also has to do with the fact that even with free will, the undead are still looked at as the monsters. It doesn't matter what faction you're in, they're the ones that, you know, they're not really that trusted. Even before Wrathgate, right? Even before all that went down, when we talked about this last recording, it took an excessive amount of, you know, somebody standing up and saying, yeah, we should let them into our faction because, you know, we should. And it took a rather high-ranking person, somebody who had a lot of clout, to even get that on the table for the Horde, let alone, you know, trying to go back to their old lives, trying to go back to, you know, the Alliance in any capacity, and being met with what was most certainly just being dismembered as soon as you touched Stormwind, right? Like, you look at that scenario from that lens, and it's like, nobody really wants you there. It doesn't matter how useful you are. I mean, you look at all the past interactions we've had between just factions and the undead, period. It's always contempt. There's always scoff at them. There's always this distrust. Then you go back to, like, the Garrosh era of things. He, you know, assigns somebody to watch her and her people and has guards all over the place because, straight up, doesn't trust her people. And I get that. So at that point, if you're looking at it, and this I think plays into the whole she doesn't feel or think like she used to, but if you're the monster, what's the easiest way to stop being the monster? By everybody being the same type of monster that you are. And it accomplishes that goal of you know, replication, essentially, of making sure that the legacy of your race goes on, because at this point she views it as a race, not a curse. It is a people. It is a race to her. And pushing that forward, if everybody is undead, nobody can, you know, view her as the monster, and she has now secured the legacy of her people for the future. So I don't think it's, I mean, how do I phrase this? I would be upset if it was somebody else actually pulling the strings. I really would, because I think she is one of the more complicated, interesting characters that we have in the entire story of Warcraft. And I would hate for that just to be, yep, she was a puppet the entire time.
I like the idea of
it just being a complicated viewpoint, and that's her solution because it's so complicated.
I think, and I'm going to go back to what Rossi said, where she doesn't ask, what are we, if not slaves to this torment? Like, she doesn't ask that question anymore. I feel like she spent the early days of World of Warcraft, and even like the end of Warcraft 3, coming up with an answer to that question. And the question, or the answer, is we are a force to be reckoned with. And that's what she's been trying to prove all this time, like build up her forces, you know, get more land, get more whatever, prove her people's worth to the Horde, however, whatever form that took. And then from there, prove her worth to the rest of the world. Obviously I don't agree with her methods of doing it, because making everybody undead, just not a good idea. I mean, I think we can all agree, that's just not a good idea. Not everybody's interested in that. I find it interesting, though, and I'm kind of looking forward to Before the Storm, because it feels like this question is being explored more. But I know, Rossi, you were saying, you know, you're undead, you could be a powerhouse, whatever. Like, people say that. They're like, you could do whatever, it doesn't matter anymore because you're undead.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, my Forsaken character, I do have a Forsaken character that I have roleplayed for on and off since vanilla, really. My Forsaken character has no interest in ruling the world, making anybody undead, or doing anything else of that kind. What my Forsaken would like to do more than anything else is go to sleep and not wake up, and actually, you know, die like she was supposed to. She wasn't supposed to come back. It was very embarrassing that she did, and she's not happy about it. And it feels like in that little preview that we got of Before the Storm that there are a faction of Forsaken who would very much like to just stop and sleep and rest and do that thing that they were supposed to do when they lost their lives way back in the Third War.
Well, I mean, you've got the Desolate Council, so yeah, you've got support for that viewpoint now.
Yeah, that's why the Desolate Council thing really interested me when I read that excerpt, was I was like, oh, okay, we are going down that path, because there are two different paths that you can go with the Forsaken. These guys have free will. So yeah, there's part of them that's going to be like, yes, let's continue to propagate and make sure that we don't die out, and let's prove ourselves to the world that we're not the monsters that they portray us to be. All of that. And Joe, I like that idea where it's like you want to make the rest of the world monsters, because once they're monsters, that's the new normal and you're not a monster anymore. That's actually really good. It's a good thought. Good line of thought there. But the other line of thought is, we were supposed to be dead, and that cycle got interrupted, and we were torn from it, and we would like to resume that cycle in whatever form that takes. And I don't think that that side of the Forsaken has really been explored, because I guarantee you that there are people there who have been kicking around since the days of Lordaeron, and they remember Lordaeron. Oh, do they remember it? They remember what it was like. They remember when King Taranis was there. They remember when it was like the height of the human kingdoms. It was the one that everybody looked up to, and then it wasn't. But they still are, and they don't like it. So every day when you're in the Undercity and you go upstairs and you go into the ruins of Lordaeron, you don't see the ruins of Lordaeron. You see what it was, and you regret that it's gone. And I don't think that that side of the Forsaken has really been explored as much. Sylvanas can't really explore it, because Sylvanas wasn't part of it. She was a high elf.
Mm-hmm.
She was from Kel'Thas. So the most that we've seen out of her is that bit in War Crimes, which was absolutely genius, by the way, the bit where she got back together with Varisa, and there was that whole moment shared between them. Christy Golden wrote that brilliantly. Like, that whole subplot was popcorn. Anything that she wants to write with Sylvanas, I am 100% behind, because she has the understanding of that character, like, down to a T. But it's that other part of being Forsaken. It's not just about Sylvanas, who is this former high elf from places far away. The majority of the Forsaken are these people that were once living and proud and noble residents of Lordaeron. You know, they aren't anymore. How do they feel? So I'm kind of interested in seeing what happens in Before the Storm on that front. I don't know if there's like, I don't think that there's a driving force or a thing that's like controlling the undead or whatever. I do like the implication that there's something in the nature of being undead that shapes your thinking towards everything else needs to be undead too. And
well, you know what just came to mind?
What?
They pretty much all the undead were created by a plague of undeath. Plagues want to spread.
Yep.
And it's a magic plague. It's not just, you know, your average disease. And it was, you know, it was made originally when the Lich King came to Azeroth. He didn't use the plague of undeath. He used his own raw necromantic power. He told Kel'Thuzad to make the plague.
There were earlier versions of that plague that dated all the way back to the War of the Ancients.
Yeah, but it's Kel'Thuzad who was given the plague to make when the Lich King actually arrived. He didn't use it. He used himself. So that's interesting, because if you think about it, that means that every Forsaken might still be seen as a plague, as a disease vector. They, you know, they might still want to spread it. The thing is that Sylvanas wasn't converted via the plague.
No, she was a banshee, and then she wasn't.
And the thing about that is that she was raised as a banshee by Arthas's direct power, and Arthas was at that time carrying around Frostmourne, so he was using the Lich King's power. So that's an interesting wrinkle in it too.
I really like that. I mean, I hate to compare it to something else, but one of my favorite, not overly done zombie things is a series of books called the Newsflesh Trilogy. And in there, it explains how, you know, sort of that contagion, that disease, spread, and it acts just like bacteria, just like virus. And that's what drives, you know, the need to of these things that fall into this undead category to bite. It's not that they're hungry. It's not that they want to eat. It's that the microbes inside of them are driving them, saying, spread me. I need to go other places. Spread me. And they're using sort of the resurrected body as, for lack of a better term, a vessel, a vector to get that done. I like the idea that maybe that's part of it, where
the undead body is just the Jaeger for the virus.
kinda.
Yeah.
We're in looking at it from the Lich King's necromantic power. I mean, we've seen that power, once directed, and this goes for all spells and rituals that we've seen throughout Warcraft, once it's directed, it keeps going, like, it until it fulfills its purpose. Look at Illidan with his, you know, opening up that little gateway and you know, going through space and time. It had a very clear direction. Even when they describe it in the Illidan novel as it's weaving its way through the twisting nether, it's following a directive that was given to it at the onset of the spell. Well, even the plague has its roots based in that sort of magic as well. So even though Kel'Thuzad created a plague, it's still a magic plague. So I'm wondering if it still has sort of that
intelligence in it that was given to it by the Lich King way back when. That'd be interesting. I like that idea.
So, Vestarin, I don't know if we actually like answered your question, but hey, you got a lot of chatter out of it. I always like talking about Sylvanas. Anyway, and the Forsaken. I find the Forsaken really fascinating. Anyway, next question here is from Belnora from Emerald Dream, who says, "Hello, Lore Watch. I had a disagreement with someone on Reddit." Of course you did. Everybody always does. That's what happens on Reddit.
Hold on. I'm going to go give Belnora some karma here.
Go for it. Anyway, over two intertwined points on Demon Hunters. They were the points. They were the existence of non-Illidari affiliated Demon Hunters and the presence of Demon Hunters during the Third War in general. They argued, the other person argued, that there is only one example of the first point, Ilsanna Ravencrest, and that the new lore around Demon Hunters and Legion does not leave room for Demon Hunters to exist in the Third War. I argued that the presence of the Demon Hunter hero unit proved both points, that Demon Hunters did participate in the Third War, and that they were independent of Illidan. What do you guys think? Have Demon Hunters in the Third War been retconned out of existence thanks to Legion? Thanks, Belnora. Well, no, we've got more than one Demon Hunter because there's what's his name out there in the Blasted Lands. Yeah.
I know who you're talking about. I just did that quest.
His name, and I can't remember his
name. Lorthamos. Oh God, I just
it's Lore something or other, and it's not Lorthamar, which is where my brain is going to, and it's not that. But yeah, he's another one. So, I mean, and he's been around since vanilla, like before we even had Brunan Crusade. He was
Lorimus Thalipides.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. Anyway, he's been around since vanilla, and he had no affiliation with Illidan, because obviously he wasn't on Outland or anything like that. He was there on Azeroth doing his thing. I don't know. I'm going to let you guys talk this out. What do you guys think as far as...
You get a first stab at this.
Do you think that Legion has like negated the instance of earlier Demon Hunters or no?
I'm not sure that I agree that guy had nothing to do with Illidan, so I can't really answer it.
Ooh,
I have to actually go look on. That guy up.
Go on.
Well, I don't know that guy didn't have anything to do with Illidan. All Demon Hunters had something to do with Illidan. They originally it was stated that the ones that existed way back in the day were copying him. Whether or not they were copying him by him helping them or not, they were copying him.
Mm-hmm.
So they had something to do with Illidan.
So it was less about, but it may have been less about, oh, Illidan is teaching these guys. Because when did he have room to teach anybody?
Yeah, he was in a hole in the ground for 10,000 years. The only time he would have had to teach anybody was right after.
So do you think that maybe these guys are an instance of people just taking Illidan cosplay a little bit too far?
Maybe.
I don't know if I would say cosplay, but...
there's another side to that could possibly be a thing, too. Because, I mean... Demons have this wonderful way of trying to corrupt whatever uses their power, right? Like whatever calls on them. And there's nothing that says that maybe they didn't whisper in a warlock's ears like, hey, you know, this is a thing you could do and it would give you so much more power in an attempt to like finally corrupt them and use them for whatever purposes. So, I mean, I think there is a precedence where it could have potentially happened without Illidan's sort of intervention, direct intervention, and I believe that they could have existed prior to Legion just as easily as, you know, they do now. I should throw out that even Lorimus Thalipides, by the way, has been retconned in the game to be part of the Illidari.
Oh, has he? Okay.
He wasn't retconned, he was recruited.
They don't
actually say he was always a member of the Illidari. They say that they find he ended up in the Twisting Nether and then they go and get him. I mean, that's not, he's recruited. No one actually says he was always a member one way or the other. It's never stated.
I feel like with him and perhaps with others that may or may not have taken up that mantle. I mean, we do have the hero units. We have the Demon Hunter hero units. And I don't think that Legion necessarily negates them. I think that with characters like Lorathmus? How do you pronounce his name?
Lorimus.
Lorimus, thank you. With Lorimus, I want to stick a TH in there. I don't know why. I'm blaming Lorthamar. Anyway, with Lorimus, I feel like with him and with any of those other demon hunters, it wasn't necessarily a matter of Illidan training those guys as it was they saw Illidan as an example, as somebody to look up to, as somebody with a heck of a lot of power, and said, yeah, we need people like that around. And I mean, they stuck him in a hole for 10,000 years, so somebody else has got to step up and do it. Maybe they agreed with him. Maybe they agreed with that assessment where he said, yeah, we need this second Well of Eternity because that Burning Legion is going to come back at some point. And when it does, we need people that are capable of dealing with them, and we need the power to deal with them. And the only way we can do that was, you know, with the second Well of Eternity. Maybe it was just a matter of they were following his example. I do know that whenever anybody mentioned demon hunters, like in game, there was this implication that demon hunters were things that people did not approve of. The Night Elves were not cool with the idea, and Night Elf demon hunters, if they did exist anywhere, they were not looked at favorably at all.
You have a lot of people who sought out Illidan after the Third War, and they ended up following him to Outland.
Yeah,
like Elandian, for example, she was one of them.
Yeah,
they have a bunch of those. I don't know where I read this, and I'm worried I might have read it in the RPG, which would make it not canon anymore.
Sadly,
but one of the things I remember reading was that there were people who basically, cosplaying feels a little diminutive, but they basically, like, they'd lost everything too, and they had no one to emulate because Night Elf Society wasn't interested in, like, hunting down every pocket of demons everywhere in the world. It was trying to rebuild after the world got destroyed. So these really ancient Night Elf ones, who might include, you know, people like Lorimus, went out and did it themselves. Like, Altruis the Sufferer is another example of someone who might have actually gone out and done it himself. I don't know if they ever actually established where he came from.
I don't think they did.
You meet him in Outland, and he's like, oh, yeah, Illidan's nuts.
Well, he does come in the Demon Hunter storyline, though.
Yeah, he does. He's one of the two options you can choose to be in charge.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean he started as one of the Illidari. It means there's a lot of this stuff where you don't know.
And well,
that's interesting to me. I would argue that the very fact that Illyana Ravencrest exists, how did she become a demon hunter? Did he teach her?
Well, I think the idea of applying the label to it, though, is really what sort of sticks it, right? Because even in the metamorphosis of Illidan through the consumption of the Skull of Gul'dan, he knew about consuming that sort of energy prior to becoming a real demon hunter, right? Like, before going full off, you know, wings, metamorphosis, and becoming the demon, et cetera, et cetera. Like, that sort of thing had been around for a while, or at least the knowledge of the ability to do that, to sort of ingest the magic or the ability or the power of something or some entity into yourself. Even if you want to go, you know, just the idea of warlocks or whatever like that, they had metamorphosis before demon hunters did. So if you want to look at it in that context, it is very well within the realm of possibilities that other mages, other warlocks, other beings that have sort of that arcane acumen that Illidan had may have seen what he did and think, oh, I could do that for myself, and went and sought those items. And since the War of the Ancients, like, there's plenty of opportunity to find things demons touched and sort of suck in that power if you really wanted to do it.
And
I mean, Azeroth is scarred with this stuff. You can go to the Fellwoods and just, oh, this rock was once eaten by this demon lord. Sweet, into me your power goes. Like, that's not outside of the realm of possibilities.
I want to go back to Illyana, because there were some, like, hastily scrawled pages and things that indicated what happened with her, and I just wanted to read this excerpt from Wowpedia that I found on her. It said that she searched for a way to strike back at the Legion and make them suffer as she had, and in doing so realized while Illidan was cold and arrogant, he was right in that fighting the demons meant making sacrifices. But in the wake of Kurtalos' death, Illidan had vanished, with rumors among the Resistance saying he had died, and others saying he had betrayed them to the demons. But confident that he was still on their side and working in the shadows, Illyana left to go find him and walk in his footsteps. Illyana eventually became a demon hunter and was locked up at the Vault of the Wardens in the aftermath of the War of the Ancients. So,
you know, what's going on with that?
Yeah, it's...
Was she locked up 10,000 years ago?
Yeah, because, like, it says she was freed 10,000 years later along with the Illidari who'd been captured on Mardum by Amaya of Shadowsong.
Yeah, so she wasn't an Illidari.
No.
And she was became a demon hunter 10,000 years ago, which would have meant one of two things. Either she self-taught herself by copying what Illidan had done.
It says that she walked in his footsteps.
Yeah.
To me, that implies that she basically followed what he did.
Yeah, which the problem with that is that she couldn't go and give Sargeras rip out her eyes because, well, he doesn't do that for anybody.
I mean, in the note, she says, Illidan is still on our side. He's working from the shadows to uncover the Legion's weaknesses. No matter how questionable his methods may be, they are necessary. I go now to find him, to walk in his footsteps and learn what I can about our enemy. Where this path will lead, I do not know, but I will do whatever I must to avenge my father and save our race from extinction. If you wish to do the same, come find me.
So it's possible he was teaching people during the War of the Ancients. It's possible he was teaching people while doing the war itself.
Or she just followed what he did and learned more about it and found her own way into the path of the Demon Hunter.
She's an interesting case, too, because of her position, right? She would have had access to, one, the Moon Guard, which were incredibly powerful sorcerers in their own right. She would have had access to the priestesses of Ilune, so she would have been able to freely go between all these different groups, which means after the Illidan thing, and I'm just thinking of like the scenario with Illidan where he had all of these, you know, the Moon Guard channel their power into him. She knew about that. She was privy to that information in one way or another. So, I mean, seeing that was possible, she could have very easily tracked down the rest of the information she needed to do this her darn self.
Yeah, but here's a question though. Here's something to think about. How common was the knowledge that Illidan had betrayed the Kaldari and been locked up? Did people know it other than like the people at the very top?
I don't think so. I think because the implication is that, you know, there are kind of rumors about his disappearance and rumors about his whereabouts. I mean, that's what it says in Ilsanna's letter. She says that rumors spread concerning his whereabouts. So if it wasn't known, like 100% known, there were at least rumors that he had been locked away.
Now, keep in mind, too, that the Wardens did not keep Illidan in the Vault of the Wardens.
No, he was kept in the Barrow Dens.
Yeah, which is less secure.
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible she got down to see him?
She had the privilege to do so, I'm sure. I mean, being the daughter of Ravencrest, I mean, he was not exactly a slouch.
And it's not like, I mean, I'm not saying she got to free him, obviously, but
could she have talked?
Really? Would the Wardens have allowed something like that, though?
That's a good question. Would they have? Could they have? This is all stuff because
they
were
pretty gung ho about not letting Taranda in there, and Taranda was the leader of the Night Elves.
Taranda was straight up there to free him, though.
Well, that too.
She straight up like, Taranda being Taranda, she didn't like go in and say, oh, can I see Illidan for a second? I need to talk to him.
She was like, hey, y'all need to let him go. And they were like, what? No.
she swanned in the door like, yeah, I'm in charge. Get out of the way. Ilsanna, being less Taranda, might have come in and said, you know, he was my father's commander of the Moon Guard. I need to know what he knew about my father. You know, was there a Hannibal Lecter type meeting where he, you know, he whispered secrets to her that she later acted on? I mean, there's a lot here, and I'm not saying that's what happened. I'm just saying there's a lot here to determine. Did that ever happen with anybody else? Did any Wardens ever leave the service of the Wardens and then no one ever saw them again? There's a lot going on here.
Well, and then you also have to keep in mind, too, that, like, depending on where he was located, where were the Wardens mainly focusing their attentions? Was it on the vault? What did they actually have in the Barrow Dens to really watch over him? And in times of war or strife, in times of great need, did they say, okay, his prison will hold, we can kind of bounce for, you know, to go deal with this over here real quick, you know, or to go maybe hunt down another, you know, threat that needs to be held down in the vaults or whatever? You know, in these windows of opportunity, who's to say who went down there or who didn't?
I'm kind of wondering if we'll hear anything about any of this in Chronicle Volume 3, because that does cover the Third War. And what we're talking about here is that in Warcraft 3, there was a Demon Hunter hero unit.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Like, it was there. It was there. You got to play it. Does the stuff, the lore that they introduced in Legion, negate that? And we don't have the answer for that question, Belnora. I'm sorry, but we don't. There's just not enough evidence either way. There's evidence on both sides, but there's no real 100%. Nobody's come up and said, yeah, none of that is applicable anymore. Like, it hasn't been.
Yeah. The closest we've got is Lorimus, because he existed in Azeroth before the Burning Crusade.
And he didn't have the tattoos. Throwing that out there.
He didn't have the tattoos, and he still did Demon Hunter-y stuff. I mean, Il-Sana obviously was only created for Legion. We know she obviously existed 10,000 years ago in lore, but at the time, she didn't. Like, we didn't have her until this expansion. But Lorimus has been in the game forever, so it was obviously intended that there was at least one Demon Hunter.
I wonder if Lorimus ever met up with Il-Sana.
That's another good question. We don't know how Lorimus got to be a Demon Hunter at all.
Mm-mm.
So
and he's not talking.
Yeah, so I don't.
So, I mean, to get back to the original question, though, there is definitely the possibility that this all existed beforehand, and I don't feel that anything in Legion contradicts that or invalidates anything that existed prior to Legion. I really don't. I think that the possibility is still very, very much there.
To be clear, the only thing that Blizzard has come out and said, yeah, we retconned this, is the RPG books. And those weren't even retconned so much as none of this that's in here should be taken as canon unless we make it canon. So all of that stuff sort of exists in a side space, and every once in a while you'll see Blizzard pull something from it and go, yeah, okay, we'll make that bit legit. But not everything in those RPG books is legit. However, events that happen in Warcraft 3, Warcraft 2...
Those are canon.
Yeah, those have all been... Supposedly, those are all canon. There hasn't been any announcement or anything about those being stricken from the record. So I'm kind of hoping that maybe Chronicle 3, because Chronicle 3 does involve that time period of the Third War, maybe it'll talk about Demon Hunters. But I don't know, because Chronicle 3 is also covering all the way up through Cataclysm. So there's a lot of material there, and they might not go into as much detail as we would like them to. Sorry, that's kind of a non-answer, but it hasn't been proven or disproven either way. okay, so I think we got time for one more email here. Yeah, I think we do.
Sure.
All right. This one is from Jonathan, who says, hi, I have a question about the future of demons. Since we're on the demon topic, we might as well just keep going. Future of demons after the events of Legion. With Argus freed, is it right that demons can no longer be resurrected using its world soul? If so, how can warlocks keep summoning their demons when they die? Are we like a mini Argus resurrecting demons ourselves? Another point, what's the future for most of the demons who served in the Burning Legion now? Surely the loss of their leaders and immortality will cripple them going forwards and will limit the power warlocks can now exercise. Many thanks for your time, Jonathan.
We have a problem with Legion and Argus in that even in Chronicle and even at the beginning of Legion, it's established that Sargeras made Mardum to imprison demons because he couldn't kill them permanently.
Mm-hmm.
He'd kill them and they'd go back to the Twisting Nether and then they'd come back.
It feels like Argus was just created as a way to like facilitate that quicker or something. I don't know.
I actually had a thought about that.
Yeah.
And my thought was based on the idea that, yes, demons can return to the Twisting Nether and eventually reincorporate. But as you pointed out, we don't know how long it takes. Another thing is demons can't seem to just come through to our universe whenever they want.
Like, no, they have to be pulled in.
They're stuck in the Nether. If you kill a demon in your world, it's stuck in the Nether. It can't come back out. The Legion, however, if you can centralize the place they all go, like if you use Argus's world soul, you tie it to the Antorus, and now all demons go to Antorus. Well, we happen to have some nifty portals right here to send you to other worlds.
Well, I think the other thing, though, the two to keep in mind about that is that, I mean, it's a planet that exists in the material realm, right? Like it's void touched, but it's not out of phase with the rest of reality. So all it was a lightning rod bringing them back in and not essentially letting them go to the Twisting Nether, or at least to me.
Well, that's it would the other snatch problem.
Them, right? Ooh, I like the idea of a lightning rod. I was just questing out in Blade's Edge like a few weeks ago, and you know how they have those little, well, they're kind of like lightning rods, and they pull in the spirits.
Yeah.
Yeah, oh, kind of like that.
The Ethereals were doing it.
Yeah, well, the Ethereals were doing it up in Blade's Edge. You had to kind of intercept it. But
that's what we do. We have so many quests that do that too. Like as a shaman specifically, like I have like 14 years of quests that I'm, you know, in sucking either the spirit out of something or keeping a spirit from going to something or moving it on to its other destination through totems and physical manifestations. So the idea that the, you know, Antorus and Argus in general became a physical funnel.
Like that soul engine was funneling, yes, like intercepting demon spirits before they could get back to the Twisting Nether.
So they never actually went into the Twisting Nether and had to be reformed out.
Where it was like, come over here instead and we'll reform you here, and it's probably going to hurt a lot and you're going to hate it, but that's okay. We don't care.
There's actually like there's a quest on Argus. When you're doing the Argus quests, you kill a demon on Argus and immediately you're told that that demon will be returning to I want to say Argus.
Antorus.
Antorus. You're told that the demon will immediately be returning to Antorus, where it will be tortured for a while before it's allowed to reincorporate.
It's that Shivara rare that's like right in that first area that you pop into when you go to Argus. Yeah.
And that leads to a couple of things. First off, where did you kill Jaden again?
In the Sunwell. No.
In the Sunwell.
Wait, no. Not in the Sunwell. No. You're talking about the other Kill Jaden fight. There's been so many of them.
Specifically, no, not in the Nether.
No.
In a ship above Argus.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right, because at the end of the fight, that is correct, right above Argus.
Do you think the soul engine managed to churn him through before we destroyed it, though?
Here's another question, though. Where did we kill Archimonde? We killed Archimonde in Hellfire Citadel, not even Citadel itself, in Hellfire Peninsula, Tanan Jungle, on the other Drandal.
But in the mythic version of that encounter, he kind of transports you to the Twisting Nether, doesn't he?
He does not die there.
Oh, that's right. No, he does has, not like, his die final there. Breath is right there on Hellfire Citadel.
Yeah, he sends Gul'dan into the Nether.
Oh, God, don't tell me those guys aren't really dead and we're going to see him come back again. Come on.
The argument has been made. The argument was made that they're both really dead because the places they died on were completely saturated with fel energy and thus acted as if they were the Twisting Nether. But we have that quest on Argus where the demon dies and is, instead of going to the Nether or dying permanently, is said to be reincarnated Argus.
Antorus.
Taurus.
If Antorus is acting as like a lightning rod for these demonic spirits, souls, I guess they aren't really souls. Do demons have souls? I don't know. That seems like the subject of a novel. Anyway, how long does it take it once they get to Antorus? Like, I mean, if it cuts down that process, cool, but how much does it cut that process down?
The indication seems to be that it takes however long it takes for Sargeras to have you tortured for failing.
Yeah.
Because that's what they say, he'll be tortured for failing. It's said several times. But there's the other thing about it. What if Antorus meant that if you killed a demon in the Nether, it still got to come back? Because if Argus counts because it's so fel-infused that dying there would kill you, that demon shouldn't be able to come back. But they straight up say, she'll be back.
And there's
a lot of possibilities to what's going on here. We need to have something that establishes.
There is another option, though, too, and this directly ties in with Warlocks as a possible answer to this as well. So what if it wasn't acting like a lightning rod and Antorus was literally just reaching into the Twisting Nether and pulling them out of it, torturing them, and then putting them back into the physical plane? And the reason I say that is because when Warlocks summon demons now, they are literally opening portals. I've spent a lot of time watching this animation, which is cool, don't get me wrong, but like they're literally ripping open portals into wherever these demons are and summoning them forth. When the imps come through, when anything comes through, that's what they're doing. They're acting as sort of a channel, a conduit.
Maybe that's why those demons are okay with like working under the warlocks, because they pop out of that portal and they go, hey, at least I'm not in Antorus.
Or I'm not in the Twisting Nether anymore. I'm not in the queue to be pulled into Antorus and be, you know, tortured or whatever the case is. But maybe that's how Antorus worked, more than just being a lightning round to capture them before they left. Maybe it's they did hit the Nether, and because Argus is so fel-infused, it was easier for Antorus to pull them out of the Nether, shove them through the torture device and reprogramming for failure, and then spit them back out into the reality, because it sort of existed as this bridge between the two, and then they can go forth and do whatever they needed to do for the Legion. And Warlocks are sort of, I don't want to say they might be many versions of that, where they can sit there and say, okay, well, I need, you know, a Voidwalker. I know where they hang out in the Nether. Let me just open up this portal, rip it open. Yeah, you right over there. Yeah, Squeak Squad, come here. And like, well, you know, send them out.
Here's the thing to think about. There's a boss in Argus that we all know, name of Varimothras.
Yep.
When you fight Varimothras, he's being tortured in Antorus.
Mm-hmm.
For yep. his failures, exactly the process we've had described. So he's clearly physically there. He's not as some kind of disembodied demon spirit. He's there physically, and they have tortured him physically. They've messed him up. If you look at him, he looks bad. And he has some things to say about the world. So he's been aware of what's going on in Azeroth the whole time. He knows about Sylvanas being in charge of the Horde. Despite him being in Antorus being tortured, he's up on what's going on. So what is Antorus?
So even if they torture you, even if you're being tortured, they at least, you know, give you a break to catch you up on current events is what we're learning yeah. here.
Or his buddies came in.
Like in between torture sessions, they come in with a newspaper and read you the latest.
Or that's part of the torture. Like, maybe. You know, oh, and by the way, that female that bested you twice, oh, she's in charge of the entire Horde now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's how badly you fail.
Rub their nose in it.
Yeah, so there's Antorus is a strange place.
Here's Antorus, my thought, though.
Universe's largest warlock.
See, here's my thought on this, though. If Kil'jaeden and Archimonde were pulled back into the whole Argus Soul Engine thing, whatever, I don't feel like that they would be treated very kindly upon their return, nor would their resurrection be expedited or anything, because look at how bad they messed up. And how many times they messed up. I mean, look at Varimothras. He, you know, he had the snot beaten out of him, but what did he do? And then look at the scope of what he did compared to the scope of what Kil'jaeden failed at and what Archimonde failed at several times over.
Kil'jaeden's failure is complicated, too, by the fact that Kil'jaeden was flat-out disrespectful to Sargeras.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
And not just to him, not just vocally to him when they were talking over the you know, green gluey thing. He's even said stuff like, now I shall do what Sargeras could not. This was a guy who
Kil'jaeden was gunning to lead the Burning Legion.
So my thought has always been, what if he didn't go back to Antorus because he didn't die? Because this whole thing has been him figuring out a way to get rid of Sargeras the whole time.
I feel like Kil'jaeden is absolutely dead. And the reason that I feel like Kil'jaeden is absolutely dead is because Velen gave him the holy boop.
Sure.
Archimonde,
but, I mean,
I think that there's
the
potential, but Kil'jaeden was blown to smithereens by the light.
See, I just have to say, isn't he the deceiver? I mean, this could have been a part of his plan the entire time.
I don't think so.
For me, Kil'jaeden is the Xanatos / Doctor Doom of WoW.
He totally is.
Wow.
I think it's theoretically possible. Whatever you think, though, I don't think we're going to see the Legion's future for the next couple expansions is to do nothing. We will hear nothing about them. We won't see them because we got other stuff to deal with, and we just gave them an entire this is their second expansion, guys. They got Warcraft 3, and then they got two WoW expansions.
We kicked their butts up and down Argus, so...
Yeah, this has been their time. They got their time. They got to be on stage. They got to be the most threatening menace that Azeroth has ever seen. And now they're going to recede back, and what we won't see or hear them for a while. We're not going to suddenly make Warlocks or Demon Hunters less effective. That's not going to happen, because that's not cool to people who chose to play those classes. But we're not going to hear Legion for a while.
I think the only part of Legion we might hear from is going to be the Nothrezim, if anything. And that's only because moving forward, I think the story is shifting more towards Void. And I think that you can't really have Void without creatures that worship at the Void.
And since the Nothrezim don't have to report to the Burning Legion anymore, they're free to do all of their crazy, creepy stuff.
Yeah. I think that thread will still get pulled, but I agree with Rossi that I think everything else on Legion, their time is done. We might get little bits and pieces here and there that are relevant, but it's not going to be quite the focus.
I would expect to see a Scourge expansion before I saw the Legion come back.
Yeah.
I'm going to bring this back full circle before we wrap up the show here, and I'm going to say that the future for most of the demons that served in the Burning Legion is much like the future of Talon once Doomfist was locked up. Doomfist was locked up, but Talon continued on in several disparate little parts here, there, and everywhere, but it kept right on going. And I don't think that we're done with demons altogether just because the Burning Legion, just because we got rid of Sargeras. There are still demons out there. They might not be united under one banner, but they're still out there. And I'm sure that we're still going to be dealing with them every now and again, just not in the collective manner that we saw in the Legion expansion. Anyway, that wraps us up for emails. Blizzard Watch is made possible due to the generous contributions at patreon.com/blizzardwatch, and your continued support means that this podcast site and community is able to thrive and grow. Blizzard Watch supporters enjoy exclusive benefits like early access to the podcast, a better chance at having your question answered on our podcast or the queue, and an ads-free site experience. And for you guys, listeners of Blizzard Watch and Lore Watch, Audible's offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. They've got a bunch of Blizzard's titles as well as a ton of other titles as well, and you can pick any one of those for your free audiobook download. Highly recommend it. The Illidan book in particular is probably one worth checking out if you want to know more about demon hunters and that kind of thing. You can download those on Audible by signing up for that free 30-day trial at blizzardwatch.com/audible, and you also help support the show. We appreciate that. Okay, final thoughts, you guys, and I'm going to final thought with something that we didn't actually bring up during the show, but it was something that I noticed this week. One of the reviews / excerpts for Chronicle Volume 3 mentioned that this was going to be the final entry in the Chronicle series. Do you guys think we need another one? Joe?
Need? I mean, need's a strong word. Want? I mean, I will never say no to more stories, but that said, I kind of understand where this could potentially be the final, because it brings us more or less up to current. And at that point, if everything keeps getting explained to death, then how are we going to tinfoil hat anything?
Okay. Rossi, what do you think?
I think it can stop here and nothing horrible will happen, because, you know, as Joe pointed out, we're essentially caught up to the modern day. And if they leave it a little vague, it means they can put more stuff in later. I definitely think in 10 years we might need another one. I mean, they've generated a ton of lore over the past few years, so. But we'll see what happens. I'm okay with it ending here, but I would, you know, I'm not exactly the right person to ask, though, because I'm sitting here thinking, what? But you could do an entire book about this. It's like, no, Matt, no. They need to stop. They need to keep. They can't keep. If it were up to me, Chronicle 3 would have just been the Third War. You know, I mean, I am not the right person to be asked, because my idea is, no, always do more lore books. Do more and more of them constantly.
I'm going to disagree with both of you, but there's only two reasons why I am disagreeing with both of you. One of those is named Rathian. The other one is named Warlords of Draenor. Come on, guys. We need, like, way more exposition on what went down in Warlords. Like, there were so many questions during that expansion that were not answered. There were so many things in there. Chronicle only answered so much out of Warlords, right?
Yeah, it answered, like, get more Warlords, though,
Draenor ancient history. It didn't answer what was going on while we were there, and there were questions that I had while we were there, like Garona. Was that our Garona, or was that an alternate? Was that Draenor Garona? And which Garona is it that was, like, working with the Rogue Order Hall in Legion? Like, what? Also, Kairos, come on. What was he up to? What was he doing?
See,
what's up with the
one,
Timeless Isle? Like, what's the story behind that place?
And that, I would not be upset if we got a novel.
Yeah.
But maybe not necessarily a chronicle.
I'm just saying, there's more material there, guys, if you wanted to crank that out. And I would gladly read it, and I don't think that I'm the only one. Anyway, if you have a question for Lore Watch, you can email that to podcast@blizzardwatch.com. Please be sure to put Lore Watch in the subject line so that we know that it's intended for the show. We'll be back in 2 weeks, and we will probably be talking about Chronicle Volume 3, because it'll be out by then. Yay! That's it for this episode of Lore Watch. Thanks, you guys, so much for listening, as always, and we will see you again in 2 weeks.
Mom
deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
ACAST powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien Podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish, but you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast, so everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com